Hi, I'm Tony Riddle, and this is the Nat Life Pod, a platform for conversation to help close the gap between wellness as an industry and wellness as a state of being. Big shout out to this episode's sponsor, XL Coffee. XL are renowned organic coffee producers here in the UK who have gone to extraordinary lengths to ensure their coffee is mold-free and has kept its antioxidant potency. XL are waking up the world of coffee. I'm a big fan and recommend you go give them a try. Use discount code NATLIFEPOD at checkout. Details are in the show notes. On this episode of the Nat Life Pod, I'm behind the mic with Professor David Nutt. David is a neuropsychopharmacologist, specializing in the research of drugs that affect the brain and conditions such as addiction, depression, anxiety, and sleep. In this chat, I unpack my own journey with psychedelics and the huge shifts that I've made through working with these powerful medicines. David then helps to explain what was actually happening with my brain during and after these mind-altering, healing, and life-changing experiences. Psychedelics have helped me and many others that I know through dark, dark times of addictions and depression. It's a really exciting time and certainly feels that we're on the cusp of a major revolution in psychiatric medicine and neuroscience. We discuss the potential therapeutic purposes of psychedelics for conditions including depression, PTSD, addiction, anxiety, and even eating disorders. I hope you appreciate the direction of this conversation and the great work that David Nutt is doing here. The Nat Life Pod is available to listen on all podcast platforms, or you can choose to tune in on YouTube. Much love, legends. David, how are we doing, man?
Well, it's good to be here and good to see you in the flesh.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. We're in our new setup. We're in London right now. For those that are tuning in, we're not in Cornwall right now. We're in London. New experience for me coming into London. And as I was just speaking to it, it's a familiar space, London. But every time I come back, there seems to be a pause between each event, and there's been a bit of time since the last time I was here. And it gives me a longer period of time to work or get a depth of knowledge or deeper knowledge into practices, like modalities, like breath. So today coming back, I have a much deeper understanding of practice. So to walk slowly and down-regulate and find that calm, steady state that I know that we can all achieve, really. For me, this is such an important conversation because what enabled me to first recognize those calm states or to even be the person I am sitting here today. You asked about how long I've been doing the podcast, mm-hmm. right? And all of this came in really through psychedelics for me. So I'm love to dig deep into the psychedelics today. If that's
we know
possible.
A bit about that.
Yes. Yeah, you know a fair amount about it. I've practiced a fair amount of it. So going back to the podcasting, I decided to run from Land's End to John O'Groats, and I do it barefoot. And part of that decision was also to raise awareness for the environment and sustainability. And so I thought it'd be a great idea with this mindset to then go and interview people along the route. As you know, it's not enough to run 30 miles barefoot. I thought I'd then book podcasts in as well and get behind the mic. But where that all came in was in a ceremony, and I was in an ayahuasca ceremony, and it wasn't my first, but it was certainly one of the most powerful ones because it helped me reconnect to a chart. It brought what I was born into. I was born into the world with club feet. So I had club feet, and my first 12 weeks of life was going into hospital, out of hospital, into hospital, out of hospital, and plaster cast boots and resetting, and then eventually braces. And I parked it, like almost like there was no memory of it. And then suddenly in this ceremony I'm sitting, and boom, these kind of braces that I was wearing just came into vision. And this message of you need to lose the shoes, you know? Because it was like it's still within me, and it's almost like what I've experienced in ceremonies, it's almost like layer by layer by layer, something else has been stripped back. And it helped get to, I think, was the core of the trauma that was perhaps leading to some of the behaviours that I was choosing, like alcoholism, drugs,
smoking, whatever it was that I was going through, shopping, you know, pacifying something, you know, through that. And it suddenly just went, right, here you go. Here's where it's at, you know. And so I'd really like to speak to that. What's happening there within that experience that can strip everything away and just perhaps highlight what the trauma is even?
Yeah, well, you highlight, yes, you do highlight something that's remarkable from our brain imaging studies. I mean, just to say, we started off studying psychedelics because we were interested in the experience, you know, wanting to know, yeah, I'm a brain scientist, I'm a psychiatrist. I've given more kinds of drugs to human beings than probably anyone ever, actually. And when every class of drug that works on the brain I've given to people and studied what goes on in their brain. But we'd never done psychedelics before because, of course, the illegal status. And I was getting to the age where I thought, well, if I don't do it now, you know, I won't do it and maybe it won't get done.
Mm-hmm.
So we set up using fMRI, magnetic resonance imaging, and then EEG, et cetera. And the staggering discovery that we've made, perhaps the most important discovery of all, is that basically psychedelics reconnect the brain.
Yeah.
And no one predicted that. People thought it would change the brain, but they didn't realize it would actually put the brain back to a state where it was when you were a child.
So in terms of neuroplasticity, thinking we're changing the brain, but really it's almost like is there a remembering in there within that?
So what happens, in parallel with this work, a theory is developed about why the brain is so efficient.
Mm.
So your brain, human brains are 10 times more efficient at computing, a unit of computing, than the best human computers. So your brain is 10 times more energy efficient. How does it do that? And it turns out it does it by downloading little programs into particular parts of the brain. So for instance, you know, you're looking at me now, right? And most all the processing that you're doing in your looking at me, your visual system, that processing is being done in a very small part of the brain called the visual cortex.
Yeah.
It's a little circuit that's running away. Everything else, hearing is in another little circuit and thinking is another little circuit. So the brain is very, we call modular. You run all these little programs. And that's called the small world brain because basically there's not a lot of crosstalk. What psychedelics do is put your brain back into a state where you were when you were a child, when everything was crosstalk, when everything was possible. And one of the theories we now have about development is that the processes of education and learning and social control are all about forcing the brain to get into modes of thinking that fit with what everyone else is doing, make you, you know, behave like other people behave, make you think. And that's makes the brain very efficient. So it is quite useful that when I'm using a word, you understand the same meaning as I use. We wouldn't have a language if we didn't do that. But the problem is, and this is why we started to move from just studying the brain to using these drugs therapeutically, if you, as you did as a child, you took those memories of your feet and the braces, etc., and you embedded them, and they were embedded, you didn't access them. You weren't allowed to access them. They've got locked in, but they were still chugging away. They've not gone, and they were distorting the way you think about other things. And when those memories are, and traumatic memories are deeply, deeply ingrained, and they have this huge impact on the rest of your life, but you couldn't access them. You didn't even know. But under psychedelics, you could, because psychedelics take that small world brain and make it a whole world brain, so you can actually get back to all the things that were there in the first place and make sense of them, or at least access them in a way you could then do something useful with them.
That explains many ceremonies for me, many experiences that I've had. Some of them have been much shorter experiences, like rather than ayahuasca ceremonies where you can sit for hours or with mushrooms, it can be a long period of time. Working with DMT, but this, it was 5-MeO DMT from the Bufo and the toad. And the first experience of that, because it wasn't for psychedelic, you normally get this understanding of it's going to be lots of fractals and images. I just went into a completely white space and nothing. And there was no Tony. Everything was just completely dissolved. And then eventually stepping out of that, going through almost what felt like an evolutionary process. And then I had shackles on me, it felt, and I broke the shackles. Can you imagine what that means, like, on a bigger scale? And then from that, I never touched another substance after that. It was like immediately. And the guy that I was working with, he, the particular person who holds this space, he originally was a crack addict, right? And a friend of him's found him and said, "I have this medicine, I think you should work with it." And he had this profound insight with it. And he went on, this was years ago now, so we're probably talking, I think I was 40 at the time, so 8 years ago. And he's healed back then. He was already at about 5,000 addicts, you know, that he'd worked with and healed.
I have no doubt that that is true. And just to share with you some quite exciting news. Just last week, we got the first funding for using a psychedelic to treat addiction that's ever been awarded in the UK. The National Health Service has given us £1.7 million to work out how we can use psilocybin, you know, magic mushroom juice, to treat people with opiate addiction.
That's such a massive breakthrough.
Yeah, absolutely. A breakthrough in the sense it's happening at all. The people conceded the value, the necessity to find them, to evaluate the value, yes.
Well, what that means to that, I mean, if we talk about the subject of even, could be not just addiction, but depression, right? You know, what that means for that, the research that's been there already from amazing people like you, of course.
And it was the depression work that led on to us wanting to do addiction. I mean, we obviously heard about these powerful effect, particularly of 5-MeO DMT, which I'll talk a bit more about if you want.
Love you to. Okay. Almost like what was going on there, because I left everything in that field where I was standing.
The answer is I can't tell you why it's different from the other psychedelics, why it's white and not fractals. But we are studying that. We are doing what we are setting up, and we will this year do the first brain imaging study of 5-methoxy-DMT. And it's going to be fascinating to know if we can tell why it's different. You could tell why it's how different it was. I hope we can, because if we can't, then we begin to wonder what the imaging is helping us with. But anyway, that study is going to start. So in a year's time, we can talk some more.
I'd love to hear. I would love to hear. I mean, I'm really inspired by the addiction work. Equally, the work around depression, because I have one of my family members suffered from depression for many, many years and was heavily medicated on it. And it didn't change for like 15 years. And what came from that was addiction then to the meds, right? And then I hold men's circles and men's work. And there's, of course, the statistics around that suicide being the number one cause of death for men under the age of 50. And I've seen it in the circles and men that have come and that are on antidepressants or been prescribed a number of different meds, because one's making them too sleepy and almost dribbling in the evening, and then one suddenly then they can't sleep. And and it seems like such a stressful process, and not just on for them, but for their families, because they're not the same person.
No.
Whereas this work, it's like,
yes,
in comparison.
It is remarkable. I mean, and just to share with you, again, the depression studies really did come from the brain science. I mean, I hadn't, 10 years ago when we started doing the imaging, I hadn't expected to be using it as a therapy. I didn't know a lot about the history where it was used as a therapy back in the 1950s and 60s. But two things emerged from the imaging work. The first was, this is with magic mushrooms, it's with psilocybin. We saw that it dampened down a part of the brain, which we knew that other treatments, even talking therapy, tend to dampen down. And we thought, well, psilocybin can dampen that down in minutes. Mm-hmm. Talking therapy might take weeks, so maybe it would be useful.
Lifetimes for some.
Yeah, and you might not even get there, yes. But then the other thing we discovered, and this is something that really was only being discovered about this time in about 2012, that there's a network in the brain, which is called the default mode network. I don't know if you've heard
of
it.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's the network which encodes your sense of self.
Yeah.
And your, it's where you are, you know, you are, you know, where you think about your past, your present, your future. If you damage that network, for instance, you know, through head injury, you become a different person.
Yeah, like your very behaviours are governed by that, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we discovered that psychedelics, during the trip, disrupt that network, which is why people have strange experiences, why people often feel that they're floating out of the scanner, they go into another dimension, they go into heaven. You know, it's because the human brain is mostly, the human consciousness is largely embedded in the default mode network. But amazingly, at the same time, this group at Yale University in the States had shown that the default mode network was overconnected in depression. And it turns out that depressed people get locked into these thought loops, these ruminations.
Like reality loops that keep going.
And they can't escape from them. And that's, you can see that. There's more of their brain is engaged in this self-referential thinking about, I'm a worthless person, I shouldn't have done this, I feel guilty. So we thought, wow, there's too much of this activity in this network. In depression, we can disrupt it with psilocybin. Let's see what happens. And so we did the study, and it was transformational. You know, people went from being chronically depressed, some people were depressed for 20 years, and after a single trip, were in a very different state. And that was real groundbreaking, and it's encouraged an enormous amount of research in this field. But despite the remarkable outcomes, we still cannot use it as a treatment. It's still illegal. So we have this horrible situation, and you can see it in one of the films we made about it, which is called Magic Medicine. And there was someone there, he experienced what you described, a man, family destroyed by his depression. He comes back to what he was after the psilocybin. And things are fantastic. You know, the daughter says, she's tears in her eyes, my daddy's back. But then the depression creeps back.
Mm.
And he's begging us to give him another dose. And we can't, because we don't have permission from the government to do it, because it's an illegal drug. And we can only use it if we've got funding for a clinical trial. And in the last 10 years, until last week, we had never got any funding from the government to pursue this work. We discovered it.
Despite the amount of research that's there.
Others have, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's...
that's come from philanthropists and other people that are willing to donate, right?
We've got philanthropic money.
Yeah.
But when you've got a revolutionary treatment for the most serious common disorder of the brain, you'd imagine governments would want to invest. But it's a legal drug. You know, the politics of these drugs have completely distorted people's attitudes to them.
Yeah, yet you then have Australia.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Parts of the States as well.
Can I talk about that?
Yeah, please do, man. I'd love to hear that.
I'm very...
How you feel about that, you know, because being that in depth with the research and then seeing it igniting over there, and that's largely your research, right?
Well, I think I can take a bit of credit for what happened in Australia. Just so your audience know what happened. So Australia, in July last year, made magic mushrooms legal as a medicine for people with treatment-resistant depression. Mm-hmm. And by the way, they also made MDMA available as a treatment for treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And one of the reasons they did that was partly our research. I went to Australia the year before and spent a lot of time talking to their drug regulators, talking to their health ministers in the States and in Canberra, in the federal government, explaining to them that, you know, these drugs were very effective, but more importantly, that they were very safe, and that These drugs were banned for political reasons. They were banned because they were seen as fueling the anti-Vietnam War protests.
Well, we're talking 60s now.
We are. We're talking the 60s. Yeah. That's right. And they got banned, and they got sucked into the war on drugs. And they're still banned. You know, it's still illegal in Australia, except if you're now using them as a medicine. But the Australian government was really extraordinarily progressive because they realised a point that you made earlier on about men in suicide. In Australia, which has got one of the best healthcare systems, and it's way better than what we've got here, a first responder, you know, fireman, policeman, paramedic, kills himself every day, despite having access to the best healthcare system in the world. And that tells you that actually we've got to do something different because there's no point in doing what we've been doing for them because it's not working.
No.
And the government, what's there to lose? What's the risk of giving people a psilocybin trip? What's the risk? Was virtually none. I mean, it's so safe. What's the possible benefit? Well, you might maybe you know, you might stop people killing themselves. It's got to be tried at least.
Yeah. I think along with the MDMA, right?
And the MDMA, of course, is even more advanced because at least with MDMA now, we've got in the States, there are two trials by this organisation called MAPS, they've been fighting for over 30 years. They knew when MDMA was banned, again, it was completely political. There was no reason, you didn't need to ban it. MDMA was banned because young people were having fun with it.
Well, even if you looked at, I was doing some research around MDMA and ecstasy because I was in that scene. And again, I saw a lot of change in that period. And within football hooliganism, shifted it.
It did.
Because crowds that were very violent towards one another were suddenly in raves taking MDMA, right? And then getting loved up.
Yeah, that's right.
And then it changed the expression.
It certainly did. It absolutely did.
That alone is like, wow.
Well, we're not allowed to say that.
No.
Because governments don't accept that. But that is one of the most remarkable social changes. So before then, people were getting stabbed at football matches.
Yeah.
In fact, my cousin was stabbed at a Bristol City ground when Chelsea came. And now, you know, that disappeared. And that, it wasn't that people suddenly said, you know, we don't go to football matches. It was because people were going in a different mental state. And that's ecstasy did to them.
And then it's rediscovered within relationships now. Was it introduced for relationship counselling?
So it started off, before it got into the rave scene, it was being used for about 10 years, sort of under the radar for relationship counselling. And that actually is a very large, what we call data set. It's a large safety data set because there were tens of thousands of couples who were had their relationships healed by MDMA. So we knew it was safe. And then it got in the rave scene and politicians started getting... Well, not what politicians, it was the media, actually. The media banned ecstasy because they could see, you know, young people having fun. And most drugs get banned because newspapers want to stop young people having fun. And so they turned on the rave scene. It was fascinating because I started working for the government looking at the risks and benefits of ecstasy back in the early 90s. And then the police were really happy. The police loved raves because there was the only time they ever got hugged. You know, I remember it well.
I think I've hugged a few policemen in those days as well.
police didn't want ecstasy banned because it was so much better and safer than going to places where people were drunk. But the drinks industry wanted it banned. Because if you look back over that period from the 1950s to the late 90s, you could see there's a rise in alcohol use. Mm. But the only downward inflection came when people started using E. And the drinks industry were absolutely terrified we would switch. And so they put pressure on the newspapers and they put pressure on politicians to get it banned. And they succeeded. And then drinks went back up. And worse than that, they started using adverts. I don't know if you remember the Bacardi Dancing Cat. They used adverts, psychedelic MDMA-like adverts, to persuade people that alcohol was as good as MDMA. I mean, it was an outrageous misinformation. And it's still banned, because unbanning drugs is very, very difficult. It's easy to make things illegal, very hard to rectify that.
Yeah, I think with that alcohol piece, it's a challenge, isn't it? Because, again, if we go back to that default mode,
yes,
you know, and people stuck in that loop with alcohol,
yes,
how do they change that? You know, and for me, it happened directly. I mean, the next second or minute after ceremony, there was not even a conversation in my head about alcohol. Whereas previously, it's like if I had a drink, I then had I'd have this whole kind of turmoil of when's it going to end? Because I'd then have another one, I'd have another one, and that could go on. And then I might have a pause from it, but there was never a stage where I was ever free of it.
No.
And we talk about recovery, right?
Yeah.
And for me, recovery feels like very much like we're just recovering over something.
Yeah, kind
rather than actually getting right down into where is this? Where does it lie? And,
well, I love the term you use, breaking the shackles.
Yeah.
Because that is a term I use a lot, and I use it for two reasons. The first is because, you may not know this, but the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson, he broke free of the shackles of his alcoholism through a psychedelic experience. And then he championed the use of LSD in the 50s and 60s as a treatment for alcoholism. And it turned out to be extraordinarily effective. A single LSD trip was helping people stop drinking for a year. And they didn't, possibly forever, but they didn't study beyond the year. And then in 1967 in America, when the ban came in, Alcoholics Anonymous were confronted with this terrible challenge. You know, could they endorse a drug which was now illegal? And there was a complete schism. And a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous said, well, we cannot endorse breaking the law. The law must be right. So we won't endorse the use of psychedelics.
Well, also they keep politics out of that. Alcoholics Anonymous is what keeps it very, very tight, right? They don't want politics in it. So it's like it's there to help alcoholics, but we're not going to get involved on a political level.
Right? So the main body of Alcoholics Anonymous, as you say, stayed outside of politics. They say the law's a law. We don't encourage people to break the law. Of course, a lot of it went underground.
Yeah.
But most people lost the knowledge that it was helpful. In fact, it was only 10 years ago that two Norwegians went back and got the original source. There were six trials funded by the US government in LSD treatment of alcoholism, but it was hidden. People knew they'd happened, but no one really published much of the data. So the Norwegians went back and they got the source data, and they showed that if you apply modern statistics to this, the impact, the clinical efficacy of LSD, one treatment, is three times greater than any treatment since. Now, I've done a back-of-the-envelope calculation. In those 55 years since it's been banned, I reckon 100 million people worldwide have died prematurely from alcohol.
Prematurely, yeah.
Now, suppose 10% of them could have benefited from LSD. That's 10 million lives rescued. How many lives have been rescued by the ban of LSD? Well, probably none. Maybe 1,000. It doesn't matter. It's maybe a million. But the equation is so stacked in favour of the treatment that it's almost a crime that we've actually denied access of these drugs to people for 55 years, simply for political reasons.
Yeah. Well, if we look at the statistics around depression, again, suicide, everything that comes with that, bring alcoholism. Could you imagine if it was like... if it was, say, a cancer treatment,
of course,
or we knew we had something that would make a 10% difference, to curing it.
Yeah.
And then we went, oh, we have this, we have all this research, but you're not having access to it, and we're not going to release whatever it is, the medicine, because we often refer to this as drugs, and I think of it very much to myself, it's been a medicine.
It's a better term,
Very different to my youth when, I did use drugs, and there was ecstasy and there was LSD and there was cocaine and there was crack and there was whatever else I could get my hands on in those days, but it was those were drugs. Whereas now I see, well, actually, with the right, I guess, ceremony, context, environment, practice, then there's a medicine there,
I think you make a really important point. Let me emphasize this so people don't get the wrong end of the stick. When we're talking about using psychedelics for therapy, we're embedding it in a ritual, and we're embedding it in a therapy.
Yeah.
And because we believe that that is the way to maximize both the safety and the efficacy.
Yeah, can we talk about what that shape like? How does it look with the medicine, with the practice of it, the setting and the therapy, because the integration is so important, yes, right, with this work.
Yeah, so, I mean, basically we see a treatment as a three-stage process. And there's a pre-stage, which is, you know, are people eligible? Do they meet the criteria? Because these are all research studies at present. Mm. Are they on medicines, which will be dangerous? So we make sure people can take it safely. And it might be useful, it might be helpful to them. And then there's a three-day process. The first day is meeting the therapists, talking through the likelihood of what's going to happen. Most people haven't taken these medicines before, so they need to have things explained to them. Often they're quite anxious about what might happen, and they're often very anxious about, they might get anxious, and so how will they cope during the anxiety? So they meet the therapists, and they're reassured. They're taught strategies as to how to deal with things if they get anxious. They gave permissions, for instance, if they want them to hold their hand, they say, and we will hold their hand, for instance. Mm. And we also encourage them to develop or to accept that it will be challenging, because when we're treating people who've had problems or have got ongoing mental health problems, trips aren't generally wonderful. They're generally challenging. So we tell them, as far as possible, don't fight it. If you fight it, you can limit where you go, but in the end, you limit the benefit. So we encourage them to go in and go through and then try to find things there which are meaningful and relevant to change. So that's the first day. Then the next day is the actual trip. And then same therapists are there and they get the medicine. We put them in a room which is relaxing and comforting and warm and got nice decorations and that, just to optimize their sort of sense of calmness and introspection and being held. That's right. Normally, they have eye shades. And they have soundtracks being played through earphones. They don't have to, but generally they want that, you know, and generally they keep the eye shades on. And then they take the medicine, and then they have the experience, which in the case of psilocybin is, you know, lasts for 4 to 5 hours. And we don't do therapy then. If they want to talk, they can, but mostly they don't. Mostly they explore their inner self. They work through their past and the present, and sometimes go to the future in their mind. And it's the third day, the day after, that we start the integration, when the therapists talk to them about what they learnt, what the experiences were, and how to build on those to reframe the way they relate to their past, their traumas, to their present, their friends and family, and develop a new way of plotting out a life.
How they re-enter.
Like you, remodeling themselves completely from being someone who was an alcohol dependent person to now someone who's now a famous podcaster.
Yeah, the labels we give ourselves, right? Yeah, I think it's a powerful piece, isn't it? I think within the therapy circles, so what's the dose? What's a classic dose for you?
So with that research, psilocybin, we use 25 milligrams, and it turns out that that's very reliable. We did some pilot work. We started off with 10. That loosens people up a bit, but it doesn't produce a full trip. And then we moved up, you know, to 20, and we settled on 25. A couple of times we've tried 30, but there is now quite a body of evidence that 25 milligrams of psilocybin is the optimal dose. And if you go higher, you actually get more side effects. And the same is actually being worked out now for LSD and DMT.
Side effects being, what would you?
Well, more things like headaches and nausea, etc.
All right, okay, yeah.
So
like the hero dosing, 5
hero
gram.
Dosing is actually stupid and wasteful and expensive.
Yeah.
And, you know, so no, hero dosing, we generally is not, we don't think it would add therapeutic value. And it certainly, we wouldn't be allowed to do it anyway, because ethically we haven't got enough safety.
Yeah, but that's great to hear if it's like 25. Yeah. But what's your opinion on microdosing? How do you see that within the therapy or?
Yeah.
If someone perhaps has depression, they've done a larger dose, and would, you know, how does microdosing then?
Well,
work
I'm very,
for them?
Very
keeps
interested.
Them in there, right?
We're very interested in microdosing, but this is where the law really is an ass.
Mm.
So 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I think now, working with Amanda Fielding and Beckley Foundation, we got permission at Imperial College to do a LSD microdosing study. Would have been the first proper microdosing study, scientific microdosing study. But the ethics committee said every microdose had to be given in hospital. And we said, well, that's a bit hard on these people because, I mean, that means they've got to come into hospital. But anyway, we could do that. And they said, and they've got to stay in hospital for 12 hours. He said, what? So you're asking people to come in twice a week for microdosing for like 6 weeks. And the hospital said, and that's, by the way, we're going to charge you, you know, £2,000 a day for each person. Yeah, so we could.
There we go.
Okay. Absurd.
Yeah.
And that's all because even a molecule of LSD is illegal.
Yeah.
So the law doesn't discriminate. And we've been campaigning for years. It's ridiculous for a microdose to be treated as a macrodose. But it is. The law is completely blunt on this. So microdosing studies are way more expensive than macrodosing studies because macrodosing study is just one day in hospital or in the clinic. A microdosing study would be
a number of days that you'd need.
So there's no good data. So we've tried to get around that in several ways. So we have done a very clever study where we worked out how people who were microdosing could do it in what we call a blinded fashion. We facilitated them sorting out their microdose into active microdose and placebo microdose. And then we were able to look to see whether the days they were actually taking the microdose when they were different, the performance was different to the days when they weren't. And it turned out that microdosing worked if you thought you were microdosing. So if it doesn't matter whether you were microdosing with...
Oh, just the placebo of the microdose,
But it didn't work if you didn't think you were taking it. But I don't think that kills the heart. I'm sympathetic to microdosing. Mm. And I'm very sympathetic for the perspective you raised, the idea that you could use microdosing to maintain wellness after you've put people into a better place with a
microdose. Because I think with the depression, there is this, you know, there's some that perhaps it's long term and there are others where it's short term. It's like they hit a reset button, but then unfortunately that kind of... the reality loop starts to resurface, right? And then they need another experience.
Yes.
Which, again, if in the world of research where it's at right now, isn't possible. Right?
It's very difficult. That needs to happen. There is something weird about depression because it does seem like it's almost like a seed of some kind of toxic plant is in your brain, and you cut it back, and for many people, it keeps growing again. And we don't know why that is, but you know, if we think if you keep chopping it off, eventually it might.
Yeah, what's that ruminating? How does the RAS, like the reticular activation system, work within that? You know?
Yeah, that sets the tone and of the arousal, and that sets the impact of the rumination on things like your heart and your breathing. But I don't think it drives the rumination.
Okay.
I mean, it's an interesting thought. Could
I was wondering about the language that we use within ourselves, whether that would have an effect then on what gets through that, almost like that, I class it as like a gatekeeper.
Yeah.
What's allowed through.
Those are two big questions that really fascinate me at present. So the first is, you know, what is the gatekeeper?
Yeah.
What is it that we can stop someone being depressed for months and months and then it comes back? Now, one of the theories is it's serotonin.
Yeah.
And that's why it's important that we think about healthy diets, diets that have enough protein to make enough serotonin, because we know if you take serotonin out of people's brains, we can suck it out using particular techniques, they become much more vulnerable to negative thoughts.
Mm.
So healthy diets... Exercise also.
Being outside, right?
Well, sunlight maybe, vitamin D. There was a variety of different factors. But also exercise. I mean, it's reset. You can build... If it's a door we're keeping closed, there are ways we can establish and strengthen the closing of the door. But then when it comes again, and this is why depression is such an evil disorder, because for most... disorders like, say, OCD or anorexia, which we're also studying with psychedelics, people know that their thoughts are wrong.
Mm.
So you can at least engage with them. And they kind of You know, they can't change them, but they know they're wrong. I mean, people, someone with OCD knows you don't have to wash your hands 30 times to get rid of the bugs. They know that. But in depression, often it starts off, people kind of know that it's not their fault. But in the end, depression switches you and you blame yourself.
Mm.
And that's of course, then why people commit suicide. And that's why depression is a peculiarly evil, you know, it changes, it turns your mind on yourself, which is just, you know, really very disturbing. And we don't understand why that is. Now, one of the thoughts is that if people get traumatized very early in life, they take on the child's view. Children are the center of the unit. When a child's born, it's the center of the universe. It's the center of the parents' universe. It cries, things happen. You know, it makes things happen. But so they think they have power. But when bad things happen, they think they have induced the bad things in the same way as they've induced the good things. So they sort of inculcate into their brains the sense that it was their fault they were abused. And when that thought gets locked into a rumination that goes on hundreds of times a day for 30 years, that's breaking that thought.
Born with club feet, you can lock it away. It's not to say it's still not guiding you or steering you, right?
Yeah, and this is again another really interesting facet of this, what you might call the neuroscience of depression. Yeah, a lot of the effort that people are, mental effort that people are using with disorders like depression, is to suppress the memory coming back.
Mm.
And of course, that's particularly true of PTSD, where the traumas are there. You're trying to avoid them. You're trying not to think about them.
Pushing it down deeper.
And then you go to sleep, and then the trauma comes back as a nightmare, and you go through the whole cycle again. But the effort of controlling, preventing access to those memories, it eventually exhausts people. And it certainly impairs other ability to do other things, like be creative or work.
Mm. Exhausting, right?
Totally. Absolutely. Exists.
Yeah, it feels like the real early stuff is so challenging to get into. Like the first developmental stages, let's call it, like the emotional development,
yeah.
Like last trimester plus 3 years even, right?
Yeah.
Emotional.
Yeah.
You can't get there on the couch with the therapist because it's early and deep.
It's prelingual. Right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so how to access that. I did very different medicine. It was Iboga, like Ibogaine.
Mm-hmm.
And after that experience, I then viewed all my psychedelics very differently.
Okay.
It was almost like, oh my God, it felt like there was a protocol to this. I felt like, right, let's make people more embodied. Let's give them breathwork practices so at least they know what the experience might be, so they're less terrified going in, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Become more in their bodies. So there was real an embodied practice. But then later on, after my Iboga journey, it was like, oh my God, so every ceremony I've been going into, this stuff's still been guiding it in theory, because I viewed it as if, unlike the other medicines where it was all very much about ascending, you know, this was very much about going in and flipping up the subconscious. And going, there's that little trauma you experienced. Let's show you that for a moment. There's another one. And it took me right in, like such an early developmental stages that I then saw that's really the root of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what then changed for me within the alcohol conversation, which we're going to get to with this that you've developed as well, I then removed the narrative of completely, but if I was to have a drink, would I then end up having another one? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So there was the no attachment to it had gone through previous medicine work.
Yeah,
whereas on this medicine journey,
it's
very much like I could even have a drink now.
Yeah.
And I know
I
wouldn't need to go again.
It is remarkable. I mean, just how well it's from Ibogaine is remarkable. And one of the reasons we don't understand it is because it hasn't been much researched, and it hasn't been much research because the trips are very long, and that means you've got to keep people in hospitals overnight to study them, and that's very expensive. And also, you know, it can have effect on the heart, and there are some people who are vulnerable. And so, you know, 5 years ago, we got some funding from a charity to to see if we could do the, no one's ever brain imaged him again. And we were wanting to do that, but we've never been able to, we've not been allowed to do it because they want cardiac monitoring during the.
Yeah, it'd be very interesting to see that. Wouldn't right? it be? Because it feels very much like it's internal. It's not out there somewhere, you know, whereas some of the experiences you might see aliens even or whatever's coming in, this is very much like I even got to witness my parents' house and I'm Tiny Tony in this moment. But it starts off and I see an eyeball and then the eyeball forms into what was my sister's face and then her body. And I'm now standing in my parents' living room, but way back to that, to identical, like the memory of that, like that storage capacity, capability that we have even was astonishing to witness that. And then again, just a huge transformation came from it, you know? I mean, you have to be very wary having an addictive kind of path because there's also being mindful of the tricks still within that conversation that could be, oh, yeah, you'll be all right, just have another one. Yeah, try one and then see if you, you know. But it very much felt after that moment that I was done.
Yeah, yeah.
And
but this question of embodiment, it's just, you know, again, you hit on something really important, which is that we tend in modern sort of Western dialogue to, you know, we talk and we use words, and words are a very, very effective way of explaining things. And but they're also quite limiting, you know, because there are things that happen we don't have words for or we can't explain. And, you know, I mean, I guess if, you know, trying to explain trips to people who've not had a trip, words don't
Can't really do it justice.
But also, I think we've become so dependent on words, we don't think about the body. You know, we become semantic animals rather than feeling. And there's this huge knowledge base growing now about, there's a large chunk of the brain which is engaged with the body. We're not, you know, obviously the brain controls the body, but the body controls the brain. Mm. And we're learning more and more about disorders, particularly anxiety disorders. There's really strong relationships between what's going on in your gut, what's going on in your heart, what's going in the gateway from those into the brain. It's called the insula. We know that's hugely important in all sorts of emotional states, and we know it can be changed with some of the drugs we use. So one of the reasons MDMA is an effective treatment for PTSD is it helps break this pattern where the body turns the brain on and the brain turns the body on. That sort of cataclysmic catastrophic emotional surge that is part of PTSD, you know, that can be dampened down and partly, you know, deflated by disrupting those circuits with MDMA.
Powerful. So powerful. This.
Yes.
Talking of powerful. So
what have we got here?
We were speaking to this earlier because, you know, along that journey of, you know, choosing to, and this particular time of year, right, people have just gone through January and for some it's been like dry January, and they might suddenly, by spending that short window of time, and it is a short window of time, it might feel like an eternity for some if they're trying to escape from the bars of alcohol. But what they might be missing then is the social experience of that. And we are a social species, right? Absolutely. And abandonment or being ostracized would have meant so many things for us from a survival perspective. And we thrive in community and connecting with others. And largely, I would say in the UK, because city life is very much like that. Where do we experience that? And it is in bars and it is in clubs. But that usually means then you're thrown into the alcohol scene. And if you have alcoholism or addiction, then you're going to avoid those places. And then it's like, well, finding a new community.
Correct.
And so can we speak to this? Because you've sent us some of this. And I was amazed at the influence that it has. Because, again, let's talk about GABA. Can we speak to GABA to start with?
Yes.
Because we spoke about serotonin. So there's a number of, I call them happy hormones, right?
Okay.
So we can call them dopamine, serotonin.
Yeah, yeah.
Oxytocin.
Yeah.
And then can we put GABA in there as
Please
well?
Please do.
Yeah, okay.
So GABA is in some ways more important than all those three you've talked about because GABA is central to everything that happens in your brain. So you can think about the brain being at three levels.
Yeah.
There's the connectivity between all those, well, maybe 80 billion neurons in the brain, all connecting with each other, you know, like a computer. And it is like a computer. It's not ones and noughts, but it's on and off. You've got an on switch, which is called glutamate, and you've got an off switch, which is called GABA. So GABA is there controlling your brain, making sure it stays on the path it should be on, right? Mm. And then you have the next level down, you have the what we call neuromodulators like dopamine, serotonin, which add tone and valence and memory, etc., emotion to the GABA glutamate system. So the GABA and glutamate lays down everything you've heard or seen during this podcast. Every memory has been laid down by glutamate. Absolutely. Every single piece of it has to be laid. There's no other way. But if you've enjoyed it, then a little bit of dopamine and a bit of serotonin has probably come in and said, that's pleasurable.
Yeah.
And if you didn't like it, you know, maybe a bit of noradrenaline's come in and said, I don't like that bit. Mm. So those sort of neurohormones, they modulate the valence. And then underneath that, there are the real hormones like cortisol, and other hormones, you know, which actually communicate between the brain and the body.
So almost in a sense, a precursor in that sense, GABA being.
So GABA controls the activity of every part of the brain, not just the emotional, everything. If you have, every time glutamate is released, there is a risk that you'll overstimulate because it's an on switch. So the best way of thinking about it is like you're driving a car, right?
Yeah.
You know, glutamate's the accelerator, GABA's the brake. You need both.
Mm.
And if you actually put your foot on the accelerator and it gets stuck, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
So GABA keeps the brain under control. Now, what's that got to do with alcohol alternatives? Well, it turns out that alcohol, for most people, alcohol is a social lubricant, and that's central to socialization. The social lubricating effect of alcohol is mediated because alcohol enhances the effects of GABA.
Yeah.
Now, in social situations, we believe that the GABA system is not active enough, which is why people are a bit tense and a bit scared. Also,
some are experiencing social anxiety through that, right?
Serious anxiety disorders, that's right. I mean, we know a quarter of young male alcoholics have got social anxiety. They're drinking because it's the only way they can engage socially.
Yeah.
But the problem with alcohol is it's alcohol is a fantastic social drug, and you can see that people who have theories it's alcohol built human society. You know, there's this theory that we stopped being nomadic and started growing wheat, not because we wanted to make bread, but because we wanted to brew beer. It's Edward Singleton's theory. I mean, it's very interesting. So the reality is that alcohol brings people together, but it also
pulls people apart.
That's right. And if you increase the amount, then it starts to do things you don't want it to do, like make you aggressive and make you dependent to give you hangovers. So what we've tried to do is find a concoction of herbs, which we have now in two different forms, which tickle up the GABA system enough to give you that socializing effect, to mimic the socializing effect of alcohol, but not to do all the bad things that alcohol does. And that's what you have here.
It's incredible.
Thank you.
I mean, really, no, well done, man, because having been somewhere someone that was on that scene and speaking to that feeling of pangs of anxiety and using alcohol then to be able to be a social
is that
animal
where you were, right?
In that sense. Yeah. And then more and more of it until I've become more of the animal, I would say, less of the social, much more antisocial animal through that experience. Very damaging for relationships around. But I think, and we've seen it, I feel there was an increase of it through lockdown again, of people then having to go back out into the world.
Mm.
And I had a hint of it. I felt a little pangs of it when I first had to then go back out to meet people, back into holding space, back into holding circle after having a 2-year gap from that. I think
some people haven't gone back.
No, I agree. I think
some people are still scared of not going
back. Yeah, and then it's like, well, how do people then go out? Well, yes, it's then perhaps it is more alcohol again, something to induce that state.
Mm.
And so if we can then bring something like this to the market that then suggests, well, actually, why not? Why can't we have bars and clubs that we can go to that are completely alcohol free?
Yeah.
And that you could go in and have a whole social experience, but also deal with the social anxiety of being in that environment.
Well, that would be our ambition in the long term.
Well, I can feel that what's there, right? There's definitely a why there, right?
But in the to get to that, I mean, we wouldn't. I don't want to stop people drinking alcohol. I just want people to have an alternative. And most rational people would choose something that was less harmful, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think with the... I really love the ecstatic dance scene, kind of the conscious clubbing or... Yeah. Sober raving, whatever we can call it, but again, this brings something else within that.
I mean, I'm all in favour of dance. I'm all in favour, but it isn't. You need something afterwards, don't you? You've got to get that conversation going. Yes, and that and that's where this, you know,
The real communication of why we're coming together,
exactly,
and also being able to remember those communications and not waking up then with the. I guess feeding the anxiety further of, oh my God, what did I say last night? What happened last night? What went on, you know?
Yes, and of course that's, just so you just for completeness, so the reason you forget things when you are drunk is because as you build up your level of alcohol in your brain, when you get to about twice the drink driving limit, you start to block glutamate. And as I said, everything you remember is due to glutamate. If you block glutamate, you don't remember. You cannot remember because you cannot lay down the memories. But the brain doesn't like that. The brain knows if you keep on blocking glutamate, you will stop breathing and die. So as you start to block glutamate, your brain is making more glutamate. So to compensate, to keep you alive. But then when the alcohol levels start to fall, you've got a surfeit of glutamate, and that makes you anxious, gives you hangovers, disrupts your sleep, and can lead to depression. Absolutely.
Further depression, right?
And that cycle. And alcohol is a very dangerous. If you're using alcohol to deal with anxiety or depression, you know, you inevitably get into a cycle where it numbs, but then it gets worse. And then you've got to numb it again. Each day you've got to numb. And then overnight, you go withdrawal, gets worse. So it's a really, you know, it's a drug which fuels the problem in the end.
Well, for me, it felt like it fuels other things. You know, like my ability to maybe navigate a path of healthy eating or to be disciplined within practices.
Oh, yeah.
It's usually diminished when alcohol was involved. I think they came hand in hand, of course, like the psychedelics and then the no alcohol for me.
Mm.
But the complete shift, like my wife said to me, I'm now on Tony 3.0, but it was, it's like being married to, like overnight within the Bufo ceremony, I would say was the run that really brought around like the massive shift because it was such a short window of time. It's like 20 minutes. And within 20 minutes, I've had a complete rebirth and I arrive at my family home like days later and Katerina's like, oh my God, it's like being married to a completely different man. Like the man that she, I guess, met with thinking that's the man, that's who's in there. Yeah. That's the man he needs to
be.
She
could see it was there.
She could see it was there, you know? And then staying clean and being alcohol free has been huge for me. But there is an element of, I think there is the social element of it is always challenged, you know, because you're breaking away from what are the behaviors and beliefs of many, because it's our cultural thing is to drink alcohol, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so of course, having a drink like this is great because it means that you do have a drink.
Yeah.
So you're not being stigmatized. He's not drinking. What the hell's wrong with him? But also it actually is helping you socialize.
Yeah.
And that's, we you know, this is the concept of the third way. You've got alcohol, which is good and bad, and you've got completely non-alcoholic drinks, which are, don't really do very much at all, apart from give you something in your hand. They're like lemonade.
Or try and mimic the taste or something.
But this is trying to do both. It's giving you flavour and pleasure, but also giving you that, enhancing that sociability. Because, you know, there is no question. I used to say 30 years ago when I'd be writing articles about the brain, I'd be saying things... The human brain is the most complicated thing in the universe.
Mm.
Now I don't. Now what I write is human society. Because, you know, you've got, what have we got, 7 billion brains. That's amazing. I mean, every brain, your brain, my brain, has more computing power than all the computers on Earth today.
Mm.
And then you've got 7 billion. I mean, that is utterly staggering. So if we can bring all the human brains together, we should be able to make the world work.
I mean, we should be able to have a massive collective shift, right?
We should be able to, exactly.
But again, if we keep numbing and dumbing and
over-prescribing. Yeah, and yes, that's right. Getting into situations now where in America, you know, you can, in San Francisco, you can, you know, you can buy an AK-47, but you can't buy a vape. There are some kind of weirdities about the way humans have gone about trying to organize life.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But man, I mean, you should be very proud of this. Well, thanks. Proud of all your research. I'm keen to hear, you know, maybe it means another podcast or another conversation down the line of where the research is going in with, say, anorexia. And
yeah, well, we're going to be reporting on the, we got the anorexia study is just finished, with pain studies just finished, and the OCD study is halfway through. And then the opiate study, fingers crossed, will be starting soon. So yeah, I'd love to come back and talk to you more.
I'd love that, man. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
It's been an absolute joy. Thanks, man.
Thanks.
As always, I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you feel drawn to do so, then please subscribe to the show, leave a review, and don't forget to share. Sharing is caring. It really helps me to help others. If you're drawn to immersing yourself in any of the NatLife experiences, or see yourself as a NatLife coach, head to tonyriddle.com for details of how to immerse yourself in the community. You can follow my adventures on Instagram at The Natural Lifestylist. Big shout out to Simon from We Are The Clarks for producing, filming, editing. Much love. On this episode of the NatLife Pod, I'm behind the mic with Professor David Nutt. David is a neuropsychopharmacologist, specializing in the research of drugs that affect the brain and conditions such as addiction, depression, anxiety, and sleep. In this chat, I unpack my own journey with psychedelics and the huge shifts that I've made through working with these powerful medicines. David then helps to explain what was actually happening with my brain during and after these mind-altering, healing, and life-changing experiences. Psychedelics have helped me and many others that I know through dark, dark times of addictions and depression. It's a really exciting time and certainly feels that we're on the cusp of a major revolution in psychiatric medicine and neuroscience. We discuss the potential therapeutic purposes of psychedelics for conditions including depression, PTSD, addiction, anxiety, and even eating disorders. I hope you appreciate the direction of this conversation and the great work that David Nutt is doing here. The NatLife Pod is available to listen on all podcast platforms, or you can choose to tune in on YouTube. Much love, legends.